Members, just for a minute, first of all, I'd like to say thank you to those of you who were here at 7:30 and, you know, here in time for the president when he began speaking. I really appreciated that, and thank you very much. And then I'd just like a little feedback from you on whether or not you felt this was a worthwhile expenditure of time and worth getting up early for. Any comments?
No.
Now, Representative Latch, you didn't get up early, so you don't get to say that.
Madam Chair, some of us still have kids to drive to daycare and other responsibilities, so I was up plenty early. What I caught was excellent.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. Representative Carlson. I should mention that, and maybe some of you saw it in the email, I think you got an email mentioning all three of them that are considered, but the third one, and I don't recall what the date is, and I don't have that in front of me, is going to be on kind of the extended day, after school time, those kinds of issues. So that might be another area that you would be very interested in attending. I think that's on a Wednesday morning, so I can't force you. But I think it would be well worth all of our time to be there if we can. I don't know what your Wednesday mornings always hold. But we're also trying to get a hearing room for a Wednesday morning to have a hearing on the Permanent School Trust Fund lands and kind of educate all of us a little bit more on that issue. We're having a terrible time getting a room big enough for this tiny committee. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly where we'll be or when we'll be able to do that, but we definitely want to do that this session. It may be that we'll wait until after the first deadline or something, but by the same token, I don't want it to get too late because we do have a resolution-type bill that is related to the permanent school trust lands that we would like to present on the same day. So our agenda this morning is to continue with House File 1789, and I'd ask Representative Olson to come up here.
Representative Sequoia, do you have an amendment that you want to deal with right away, or is that for later?
Since we had the opportunity of holding this bill over, we did try to address some of the issues that were raised here, and one of them is clarifying the language on page 9, which dealt with holding up money for some districts that have not submitted their financial data, and I think it just clarifies it. So 9 section B would read, as you see on your page there, line 4. So instead of the present language, it would read, if a district does not submit audited financial data or an audited financial statement according to section blah, 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 the commissioner may withhold the district's state aid for the school year until the audited financial data or an audited financial statement have been submitted to the commissioner. So that makes it very clear that, yes, they're going to get their money. It's just going to be held up until they meet their responsibility of submitting the data.
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, before we go on, or Mr. Chair, before we go on and look at the rest of it, did we, there was also discussion, Mr. Melcher talked about there would be a due process for districts if they were disputing, you know, whatever, and that it might be, take 3 months or whatever. And he seemed to say that there's other language somewhere in law that requires them to have some kind of due process. I would be more comfortable if that was also cross-referenced in this amendment. because there is no talk about any kind of due process.
Representative Sikora.
I'm sorry, but I have to refer to House research on that. Or Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Melcher?
I didn't see you sit down, Mr. Melcher. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Segrin, this amendment is an amendment to Minnesota Statute 127A.42. And this is just one of the subdivisions. The other subdivisions of that statute provide the other details of that that due process.
Okay.
So those are already in current law.
Representative Sikora.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Representative Segrin?
Yes.
Okay. Moving on, I'm going to turn this over to Lisa Larson, because she has the only language. We found a couple little things that would be better changed slightly on the amendment. So I would like to move that along with the amendment, the different language. So could you, Ms. Larson, could you go over that, please?
And excuse me, but before we do, Ms. Larson, Representative Sikora, at what is there a point you'd like to take questions? There's a few members that are raising their hands as we go here.
That's up to you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I would like to move the adoption of this amendment, though, so that we have it on the floor for discussion.
Okay. First, Representative Sikora renews her motion for House File 1789. Where does this need to go to get it before?
To civil law. It's going to go first to civil law now because of the civil law issues.
Okay. And to get the bill before us, Representative Sikora moves House File 1789 be recommended go on to civil law, be recommended to pass. Mm-hmm. And you want to move that amendment now to this bill?
I would move amendment 0843.
Representative Sikora moves to get the bill in the order that she would like it. Amendment 0843. Any other discussion on that amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment is adopted.
But Representative Olson, Mr.
I'm sorry.
Chairman, we have a couple of minor changes to this amendment, believe
I'm
it or
sorry.
Not. And that's what I was asking Lisa Larson. She has the only copy. She found a couple things that she thought would read better, slightly different.
Begging your pardon, I misunderstood that.
No problem.
Okay, Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair, members to the document A04-0843, there are a number of changes that the department and others have requested. On page 1, line 14, delete the word after and insert the word delete. So it would read delete or and insert, comma, legally. And after line 14, you'll need to insert page 10, line 25. After parents, insert, or parents residing separately. On page 1, line 15 of the amendment, delete the word after and insert the word delete so that it would read delete or and insert, comma, legally. And after the word parents, insert or parents residing separately. The point here is to accommodate three different circumstances when you have parents of a child not living together, where the parents would indicate the residence of the child for purposes of school funding. So in order to take care of the circumstances where both parents are legally separated and also parents who are residing separately but without the benefit of a formal separation, in these three instances, divorce, legal separation, or residing separately, the parents would indicate the residence of the child. And then on page 1, line 23, after the change from 5 to 10, insert, and after days, insert, comma, consistent with sections 121A40, to 121A56. Those sections encompass the pupil fair dismissal law. So what this indicates is that special education children who are subject to suspension during the period from 5 to 10 days, consistent with the pupil fair dismissal law, would have a number of alternative education services available to them as prescribed in the pupil fair dismissal law, which encompasses anything from homebound tutoring to services indicated in the IEP. And the definition of alternative education services is in the pupil fair dismissal law. Those are the changes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Larson, did you have 10 consecutive days? Did you have that? Consecutive days? Doesn't it have to be 10 consecutive? It doesn't work. Is it supposed to be consecutive days or just 10 days?
Madam Chair, under federal law, it can be consecutive or cumulative.
Oh, it can. So just 10 days works then. Okay.
Okay, I have a question. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, we need a motion then to adopt Ms. Larson's recommendations. So
that's right. Okay. Representative Carlson moves the amendment as defined by amendment to the amendment that's already been adopted to the bill as defined by Ms. Larson. Does everyone understand the amendment to the amendment that's been adopted to the bill? Technically being an amendment to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I should probably mention two areas that were deleted in the bill.
Pardon?
I don't know if everybody's noticed that we deleted two sections from the bill. Right. So at the very end, page 34, delete section 2. That was the rulemaking piece that was very controversial, and that is being deleted. And the other one was page, 22, 23. And then under page 23, under special programs, we are deleting that section 1. Because what we were, what they were trying to accomplish with this is to protect the information under maltreatment investigations from being accessed by a variety of people, such as attorneys, press, etc. However, from what we understand, that would also have possibly deleted the parents' ability to access that information. So we'll have to look at some other way of doing that. We could not get a definitive ruling from admin and agreement on exactly what this would do. So we don't want to make any mistakes here. We're just going to delete this for the time being.
And Madam Chair, as I understand what you're saying, you're describing a part of the amendment that we've already adopted.
Right.
Yeah.
But I wanted everybody to know what they adopted.
Thank you.
And you have to adopt then the changes.
That's correct. Would you, okay. Representative Carlson?
I just wanted Representative Sikora to know that some of us clearly noticed the deletion of page 4. Didn't go unnoticed.
I'm glad you're not asleep, Representative Carlson.
We're all being tested this morning. does everyone understand the amendment, the added amendment to the bill? Are there any questions? Or would you like it all restated? I see everyone shaking their head. All those in favor of the Carlson motion to amend House File 1789 as stated by Ms. Larson, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Sikora, to the bill as amended.
We have a request from Roger Aronson to address this, the 10 days and whether it should be consecutive, et cetera, et cetera. Would you like to hear from Mr. Aronson?
Okay. Mr. Aronson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Roger Aronson. I represent the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals. We've visited with council. Council for the School Board Association and Council for the department reps as well, and with the author, and we think in the amendment that you just adopted, where we shifted 5 days to 10 days, it should say 10 consecutive days. The goal being that we be consistent with federal law and not more restrictive than federal law. And we think if we use the word consecutive there in that amendment, that will achieve that purpose. And I think we've got everyone agreeing to that at this time.
Representative Sikora.
If this is fine if that's the way it should be. I'm fine with it. I just wasn't sure which way it was supposed to be.
So do we, Representative Sikora, do we need a motion or?
Yes, we would just add the word, let's see, where does the word consecutive go? Right after 10, which is the issue I questioned a few minutes ago, whether or not we should make it 10 consecutive. And so is there any comment from committee members on that?
I see no one raising their hand, Representative Sikora. Do you want to state the motion?
Yeah, I would move that we insert the word consecutive after the word 10. So it's 10 consecutive days.
Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion, I assume Representative Sikora, it's clear exactly where that should go?
Yes, on page 30 of the amendment, where deleted 5 and inserted 10, you just add consecutive right at that point.
Okay, thank you. All those in favor of that motion? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Same sign. The motion is adopted. The amendment is adopted. Excuse me. Representative Sikora.
There was one other section of the bill that was apparently inadvertently skipped over the other day, and I didn't even notice it at the moment, but that was on LEP, I believe. And so what we have somebody here to address that part of the bill so that you feel fully informed and ready to vote. All right, we'll have Jesse Montano. And Jesse, would you give me your current title, please?
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Montano. I'm director for NCLB Consolidated Programs. So I got the whole enchilada, so to speak.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to be here. There's a handout going around that I think will help you understand one of the amendments that I'm going to be speaking to. There are three amendments that we're asking for, Section 7, in Section 7, Section 8, and Section 11. One of the...
We passed that amendment last week.
One of the requirements under NCLB Title I and Title II is that the state adopt what they call annual measurable objectives in two areas. One is establishing an annual measurable objective to determine the rate or to ensure that students were acquiring English language skills. And the other annual measurable objective was to measure the academic achievement towards the state standards using the state assessments in the area of reading. So the one-page handout that you have before you complies with the NCLB requirement under Title I and Title II, but it also, I think, helps clarify many of the questions that are frequently asked by legislators and other constituents with respect to ELL learners. There are basically three stages that ELL learners go through in their educational process to acquire English language skills. The first one we've defined as Stage 1, and that's what we're calling an English language learner. A student in this stage, their English ability prohibits that student from assessing full range of mainstream content. And we identify an ELL student as a student who has a home language questionnaire that basically that questionnaire indicates that that student's first language is other than English, the language spoken in the home is other than English, or the language most frequently used by that student is other than language. Other than English, and that student has not scored proficient on the state assessments for ELL. We have two state assessments for ELL. One is called the test of emerging academic English, and an exit criteria for a student out of stage one would be that they would score 4 out of 4 in the T test in reading. Also level 5 of 5 in the T test in writing. And then we also have what we call the MinSolim, which is an assessment of listening and speaking skills, and a student would have to score 4 out of 5 in the MinSolim listening and speaking. Once a student scores in those levels, they enter stage 2, and we're calling stage 2 a transitional language learner. In this type of student, their English ability may be an intervening factor that inhibits the student's ability to access the full range of mainstream content. The way that a student would exit from stage 2 into what we call a fluent language learner is that that student would have scored proficient on a state reading assessment for all students. In other words, they would have scored in level 3 or above in the relevant MCA reading for 3 times or as many times as the MCA was offered in the student's last 3 years. That student, once they achieve that, would go into stage 3, which we call a fluent language learner. And a fluent language learner is one whose ability is no longer a factor in the student's ability to access a full range of mainstream content. I think that that helps one clarify what the stages are of an English language learner. And secondly, it also allowed us to establish annual measurable objectives in the two areas, one, the acquisition of English language skills, and secondly, the achievement of students towards reading, towards the state's content standards using our state assessment. The second is Section 8, and this is a clarification. It is not new language. Back when this law was first passed, and unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I was around, the good or worse, I don't know, the formula for funding programs for ELL students was on a pupil-teacher ratio, and if you had 45 students, you had you received funding for a full FTE. If you had 22 or less students, you receive funding for up to a half-time FTE. So the intention all along was that even if the district had one ELL student, that that student should have the opportunity for special service with respect to their English language skills. And so while this looks like it's new, it's just clarifying what was there when we had a pupil-teacher formula. And then finally, Mr. Chair, Section 11, Revisor's Instruction, changing limited English proficiency to English language learners, which is, appears to be the more appropriate term to use now rather than English limited English proficient.
Any discussion? Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Montano, talking about the process for exiting stage 1 to stage 2 to stage 3, when is the first time that the T-test is given to a student?
Representative
Segrin. The test is given every year, and there is no exemption. It's given in levels, so a student that is new to the state would get a very low-level T-test that would, and then they progress in terms of levels. So it would be immediate when the test is given, and they're usually given in November.
Representative Sikora.
Segrin.
Excuse me.
Sorry. Mr. Chair. Ms. Montano, so a first grader could be given the T-test? Or is it at third grade when the normal MCA would be given?
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Segrin, I believe it's, and I'm going to have to double check, I think it's at the third grade would be the first time. But I will double check on that and get back to you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Segrin.
Follow-up then. So then the way the stage 2 reads, let's say the T-test is given for the first time for any student that's an English language learner at third grade. Then they, and that child for the first time in third grade scores a proficient level or a 3 in reading. But then it says they have to then score two more times or three more times after that. So does that mean that they then have to score proficient in reading in fourth grade and then in fifth grade and then in sixth grade before they actually can exit the ELL program and be considered proficient?
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Segrin, yes, that is correct. And one of the reasons that we are looking at a student achieving that score three times and doesn't have to be consecutive is because that's the level where we see that once they reach that, they need to be monitored. And all too often we see students slipping back. They may pass the first time, and then they stop receiving any kind of support, and then all too often we're seeing these students slip back into an ELL stage. And so one of the reasons that we did this is because that would require a monitoring of students to make sure that they don't slip back. If they start to slip back, that some kind of support, maybe not as intensive as they received as an ELL student, that they would receive some kind of support so that they don't slip back into an ELL stage. And for that reason, we are looking at three times. And obviously, once we get test 3 through 8, it'll facilitate it. And at this point, because we don't have the test at all levels, I think that's why the language is written as it is.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sikora.
So just to clarify, though, it's three times, not you score, you take the test for the first time in reading, and then you have three more requirements to take it. It's three total? Okay.
That
and it's
correct.
Only in reading? It's not in math or science?
That is correct.
So they have to, so they could be scoring lower or higher in the math or science, but it's the reading that you're really focusing on.
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Segrin, that is correct, and basically if you don't have good reading skills, you're not going to do very well on the mm-hmm. on the science test and right. even on the math where there's language involved.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion? Okay. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to ascertain what Subdivision 3 in Section 7 in regards to the essential instructional personnel. I'm wondering if maybe Ms. Montano can tell us what that language does, that new language striking.
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, are you speaking of lines 14 through 19?
Page 20, lines 14 through 19.
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, that language was written back when the state first passed a bill to serve ELL students, and at that time we did not have licensure in the area of either ESL or bilingual education, and so we did not have teachers trained.
Okay.
And so that was kind of a provision that was written into the law that would require teachers with some type of license, mostly it was elementary, that they would receive training at least, I believe it was 3 full days of training that the department would offer 2 or 3 times a year and give these teachers some type of a certificate that they would at least enable them to understand the difference between teaching an ELL student and teaching a monolingual English-speaking student. And because we have had license now for a number of years, that's no longer necessary.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr.
Representative Mariani,
basically just acknowledges where that category that license has evolved to and clarifies that these teachers are in the same category as other teachers in regards to whatever rights or obligations flow from being considered essential or non-essential.
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, for the money on it, that is correct.
Further discussion to that point? Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to belabor this point, but on page 20, it's still unclear to me about how many times a student would be required to take the test before they exit. The way it reads, it says they would be given the standard, the I have to go back to page 19, I guess. The pupil has scored in the proficient level on the state reading assessment aligned with the state academic standards for 3 years, or for as many times as the state reading assessment is given during that three-year window after the pupil receives scores indicating attainment of English proficiency. So it's... I still think we need to clarify that it's three times, not... It sounds like it's almost four.
Ms. Montagna.
Mr. Chair, Representative Segrin, it is three times, and it depends on what grade a student is in right now, and hence the language, because we don't have assessments in each grade, but it is three times, not four.
Representative Sikora.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Segrin, the amendment that we passed the other day when we started.
I'm disappointed. That was just pointed out. I will not belabor it anymore.
Thank you.
Apologize to the committee.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Sikora.
Well, hearing no further discussion, I would renew my motion to pass this bill and send it over to civil law.
As amended.
Okay. As amended.
Representative
yes.
Carlson.
To as you know, I had a question earlier, but I waited because it was on this of Mr. Melcher.
Okay, I'm sorry. There's still time, Representative Carlson. I'm sorry. I didn't realize you had an ongoing question.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, my question is on page 5, and I raised this question at the last meeting. Is Mr. Melcher here? I know he was earlier.
Will Mr. Melcher come to the table, please?
But the lines 21 through 24 dealing with the reporting of salaries by building. And my first question, Mr. Melcher, is if you could refresh my memory as to the why. And then, if you recall the other day, I indicated that there may be differences in costs very legitimately between buildings for a variety of reasons, and I felt that perhaps there should be some explanation that goes with this rather than just the reporting of the salary. And so the second part of the question I have to answer first, for example, if you have a school district with multiple high schools, and some of those districts were to operate magnet schools at some sites, or maybe even magnet schools at all sites, but magnets have different cost ramifications. For example, you could have a technology magnet, and with a lot of shops and that kind of thing, and smaller classes, that kind of an environment. Mm-hmm. Unless there's some explanation that accompanies that kind of report, there would be a lot of misunderstanding on the part of the community, I think, in terms of what those actual costs are. So if you could refresh the why and then explain maybe as the bill moves along how we could have some better language in there that would help understand what some cost differences might be between sites in a district or similar schools in different districts.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, this section of the bill is a modification of a practice that we have in current law, which is being repealed as part of this bill, which requires school districts to annually allocate general education revenue among buildings based on the way that it's generated under the state formulas, and requires a reporting of both revenues and expenditures by building for each school district. What this is intended to do is to not change the general policy that was established as part of that earlier legislation, which was to make available to the public at large, to parents, to the greater community, information on a building-by-building level, which allows a better understanding of the revenue flows and the expenditures that are being made at each building. This amendment does not attempt to alter that that general policy that was made earlier, but to simply simplify some of the calculations for the school districts. Currently, one of the things that the school districts have found to be the most difficult is reporting of the general education revenue allocations by building, and we've had a great deal of difficulty trying to match up general education revenue allocations with general fund expenditures, because school districts' general fund encompasses more than just the general education revenue. It encompasses a variety of other sorts of things. So it was an attempt to take this current law requirement and to, on the revenue side, look at all revenues in the general fund, on the expenditure side, look at all expenditures in the general fund, and to try to create something that was a little bit, that was aligned better. As far as the background in terms of why the legislature adopted that policy a few years ago, I think it was an interest in creating greater accountability for school districts in terms of information at the building level, trying to align the financial data with the outcome data that we are currently producing on a building by building level. The report cards, for example, that were issued this last summer by the department showed all of the data except the financial data at the building level. This is designed to try to create a little bit more uniformity among school districts in the way they report the financial data at the building level, so that also can be put on that same document, so that the public or parents would have access to information all in one place that would show the demographics at the building, the outcome information, and the financial information all at the same unit of analysis. As far as the reporting of actual salaries as opposed to an average, that's the standard accounting practice. If we're looking at the expenditures in a particular building, normally the standard accounting practice would be you would look at the actual expenditures at the building and not a prorated number based on a uniform rate. And you are right, there are some buildings that have higher average staff experience and training than other sites, and that will reflect higher expenditures at that building. Is other information available on the report card or the department website which provides context for that? Yes, there is information on the report card and on the other areas of the department website which identifies teacher training and experience levels, for example. I don't believe that the current documentation would provide information going into the levels of detail that you described in terms of whether there was a particular type of magnet school program at a particular building.
Mr. Chairman, I use that as an example because I know it could be a cost driver. I think you're going to have some misunderstanding with that without somehow getting some mm-hmm. clear explanation. And let me give you an example of a debate that I was in for many years when I chaired the Education Division of Appropriations. I would get letters pouring out of St. Cloud about why they didn't have the same funding level that Mankato State did. And we'd bring the chancellor in. And he would give us a very detailed explanation that St. Cloud State was much larger undergraduate program, and Mankato State had a much larger graduate program, and therein lay the difference. But it triggered in those communities in the higher ed sector a big debate, one feeling they were being unfairly treated. And I'm only raising the question here, if you're going to begin to compare actual site salaries without some explanation, you're going to have one part of a community feeling that perhaps they're unfairly treated versus mm-hmm. another community facility, or maybe even cross district lines, but especially within a district mm-hmm. that would have multiple school sites. And that's the reason I raised the question. I don't have a proposal to make here other than to say that I think you've got an issue there you should look at as the bill moves forward, you're going to have some superintendents and principals that are going to be trying to explain things to communities that feel that their school site is being underfunded, perhaps, when it really is not, if you had a good understanding of the program differences between two sites. And therein, I'll stop.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Could Commissioner Nelson come to the table so I could ask a question under her section of expertise? Commissioner Nelson, on page 16 under school accountability appeals process, specifically the school performance report cards, could you tell us to what extent the parental contracts or parent involvement is going to play into the report card? For example, will parent contracts, according to this proposed legislation, be available on the internet under the report card so that there will be, in effect, a judgment upon parents who may have signed a contract let's say about their children's school attendance or about watching television, you know, what they're going to do to improve, raise the test scores, improve the achievement of their children. And I'm especially concerned about low-income parents who may sign a contract and then find that there's been a judgment upon what they may or may not be doing, and that appears under the student report card, the school report card. Would you comment on that in regard to this section?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, could you, I'm sorry, I'm having difficulty tracking. Could
page,
you tell me which?
Page 16, line 23, subdivision 1 under school performance report cards. And the fact that the commissioner shall use objective criteria based on levels of student performance to identify 4 to 6 designations applicable to high and low performing public schools. The objective criteria shall include at least student academic performance, school safety, and staff characteristics with a value-added growth component added by the 2006-2007 school year. What I'm wondering is, in any way, shape, or form, does this criteria also play into the fact that parents may have signed contracts to help teachers and themselves and their children improve their learning? And will those contracts, if so signed, become public? And will there be a judgment then upon those parents if they're not doing that? I mean, I think, you know, there could be that possibility, and I wanted your comment on that.
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, a contract signed between a teacher and a parent is typically only communicated back to the parent, and then perhaps the format for that contract to the rest of the classroom. There is no intent to put those on a website that I know of.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Nelson, if a school applies for a grant under No Child Left Behind and it's the parental involvement, could that contract then become a part of that as far as public knowledge? You know, I don't know. I'm just posing these questions because I don't want parents' privacy invaded. Although I think it's very good that parents and teachers become more involved and set a standard for children to achieve and learn.
What's on the school report card is data in the aggregate. It's not going to identify a particular classroom. And in Minnesota, we have a long-standing practice in schools as well as this department to guard parent privacy and to guard student privacy. So I would say there is nothing in this bill that would jeopardize that.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
So Commissioner Nelson, the parent appeal process that could occur under Public Law 107-110, if that did happen, would this be the channel through which parents would work just in case? I mean, we don't know. And I hope, you know, that nothing is going to happen so that parents feel disjointed now from their school because they perhaps didn't get their children to school like they pledged to do in the contract. You know, so is this appeal process available to parents who might feel that they have had their privacy invaded?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, which appeal process are you referencing? I want to make sure I answer the right.
17 under the adequate yearly progress.
Commissioner Nelson.
And what
subdivision two? Well, the whole section, subdivision, actually the subdivision two. There's an appeal process that's noted. Districts must provide parents in line 16 sufficiently detailed summary data to permit parents to appeal under Public Law 107.110, Section 1116.
I think I'm going to have Greg Marcus, the head of our No Child Left Behind, answer that.
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the section that the representative is referencing is only pertaining to the data that goes into the AYP process, and the federal law provides for an appeal process for parents to be able to initiate with their principal if they think that there has been a factual error in the AYP data.
So one last question, Mr. Chair, Mr. Marcus. Then, do you know for sure that parental contracts between teachers and parents will not be a part of the AYP?
That is correct.
Thank you.
And members, we're running out of time. I apologize, there's two that had questions and I didn't realize. Okay, Representative Segrin passes. Representative Bernardi, can you be very quick?
Yes, I will. No comment here. I'll just have the question, and it was Mr. Melcher. He did email me back regarding transportation costs. They are, as I understood in his email, non-public school costs are rolled into the public school data that will be showing up on this internet for transportation costs, and he may want to comment on that. And then the other question I have, is there a place on the website for us to be gathering data, or is there plans to do it to include public dollars spent on public education for the textbooks, counseling, and transportation? Will we be getting that data for the public to know that?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bernardi, I did check the accounting practice after the last hearing and confirmed that the textbooks and guidance and counseling and so forth is accounted for by school districts in the community service fund, but that the transportation cost that school districts incur as they transport students to non-public schools is accounted for in the general fund. And so the kinds of reports that school districts currently do in terms of showing their total general fund expenditures and their general fund expenditures per student do include a small amount of expense for transportation of non-public school students. About $25 million statewide, roughly $25 per pupil unit in round numbers in the average school district. That would be roughly 0.3% of the total expenditures of a school district, but could be higher in some and lower in others. Because this reporting structure is linked to the total school district general fund costs, this language in this bill would include that as part of the overall school district cost in the general fund. And there are two ways you could address this issue. You could amend the bill to exclude the cost of transporting students to and from non-public schools, so it would be only the cost of the cost of serving public school students directly. But the downside of that would be that then it would no longer tie out to the school district's general fund expenditures. And the other option you could do if you were trying to reconcile this would be to have the school districts report the transportation costs for non-public schools in the community service fund, which would pull it out of that area. But that would require some additional work on the part of school districts to separately account for the transportation costs for those students as opposed to other students. In many cases, these students are on the same bus routes as public school students, and all of the costs currently are reported in the same finance code, and that would, you know, if you were trying to separate out the accounting, you would require the districts to do some additional accounting work to separate that out. So our recommendation in this bill was, because it's a relatively small amount of money, 0.3% of the total expenditure, while it does slightly overstate the cost per public school student, it is part of the overall school district operation, and we recommend just leaving it in there. But there are other options.
Representative Sikora renews her motion that House File 1789, as amended, be moved to Civil Law Committee with recommendation to pass. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the bill will move to Civil Law with recommendation to pass.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members, for your patience throughout this whole procedure.
Thank you, members. Committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Productivity has some minor mineral potential. If you go inland a little further, there's more mineral potential in some of the Blue Gabbro, and I think these are in the volcanics. So they have some small mineral potential, but not great. And that, having said that, that's when you find something in the wrong place, of course, because if you knew where it was in the first place, you wouldn't have to mess around with all this. Basically, this is mostly timberland in this case.
And I think, Superintendent, that's the question, is that we have to do a similar valued exchange. So if it was known to have...
The appraisal system kind of keeps everything
exactly
balanced. And that's helpful. Thank you.
The potential income-producing capacity of that property would show up in the appraisal.
And I'm reminded that minerals are not being exchanged because under the Constitution we don't exchange minerals, we retain minerals. So, but both sides would be in a similar position on minerals regardless.
Commissioner Chairman. But my concern is, and this is a very good point that Dr. Jensen brought up, is when you look at our gross and our net, we do far better from mineral leases than we do with forestry because of the other expenses involved with forestry. So perhaps it may want to be the sense of the committee that are going, and I realize that your point is that, you know, occasionally you'll come upon a parcel of land where no one knows what the mineral resources are, and then suddenly you've got a windfall. But if you know the value, and that value is part of the appraisal, then in the long run, we're better off exchanging for mineral as opposed to forestry, because of the added overhead, so to speak. So just as a way for us to think about future exchanges.
Yes. Madam Chair.
Mr. Bryce.
Commissioner, the legislature has made a decision that, and has done it for quite a few years, that management fees against minerals are borne by the general fund, and management fees against timber management and forestry is borne by the income from the lands where that land came from. And so that's a legislative decision. And we just, you know, the mineral side is general fund appropriated, and that's the way it's been for a long time, and we have, and under the laws, we have never subtracted expenses except for these a couple of unusual events in the last decade or so where single one-time things happen, but generally that's just the way the legislature has decided to fund these agencies.
I understand that flow. I think what Commissioner Yecke is saying is that 200 and some thousand bucks worth of timber is going to yield about 40% in revenue. 240,000 worth of mineral land will be less subsidized or otherwise. And the piece that I can't remember is whether or not you can actually exchange mineral land to the trust fund for trust fund land. I don't know if we've done that in the past or not. And it never occurred to me as to why not, because the meetings have always been quicker than this. So the question is, can you even exchange the mineral lands? I mean, the point is well taken. If it's subsidized by the general fund, the net to the state may not be very good, but at this point, we don't see that. All we see is the difference in the overhead cost between the two types of land, and when we exchange for this land, we're going to get considerably less yield because we're going to have an overhead charge for that land that's sizable.
Mr. Bryce.
Well, can you do it?
Mineral rights.
You cannot.
You know, just like we can't sell mineral rights. So whatever account mineral rights are in,
stay.
Right, they stay in that account. We generally don't have general fund mineral revenues because we don't acquire mineral lands that are worth a lot because they aren't available. So, like, if we were to try to exchange, does this make any sense?
You're not, Madam Chair, Ms. Bryce, you're not getting very many tax-forfeited mineral lands because if there were something, they're generating revenue.
And those go, of course, back to the local taxing districts. And so the general fund portion is the 20%. And we have gotten quite a bit of tax-forfeited mineral rights on the range in recent years because the economy is, for our north, has been kind of bad. And so we are picking up mineral rights, and I suspect over the future years those will be valuable. But we don't have acquired mineral rights that we could exchange for a trust fund. Like we happen to, this land we acquired through a gift, and we don't have many people giving us things. We have a few lands on the range that is stockpiled. Those have some potential for construction materials in the future, and we're looking at those for managing those for minerals. But so the other area, of course, is sand and gravel. And I think in the future there is a lot more potential in sand and gravel, and that's a surface right. And so if you were exchanging some of these lands for a good sand and gravel deposit, that would provide income to the trust for many years to come. We're actually involved in a lease just north of Grand Rapids. We're working on negotiating one with the county, and I think there's about, here's, now this is my memory, but it may not be good, around 400,000 cubic yards of good gravel on that site, and that site is worth at least $1 a cubic yard. And so it's a 12-acre site. It's worth about $400,000 if they mine it all, and the plan is to reclaim it as a wetland, which the county needs for replacement. And so it seems like a kind of a good deal, and we're working on that one. So there are those kinds of instances out there where you could exchange for sand and gravel, but not necessarily taconite or copper nickel.
May I ask just a point of clarification so I'm sure I'm understanding you? If mineral rights are not transferable, and if you look at Table 2, the revenue from mineral leases, this is not land that has been part of an exchange. This is land that was originally in the trust.
Table 2 on which sheet?
On the handle sheet.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. Generally not part of an exchange. I can't imagine any examples where there would be an exchange in there.
So, Mr. Bryce, if diamonds were discovered on some permanent school trust fund land, that income would go to the trust?
Yes, Madam Chair.
But I don't suppose there's a whole lot of exploration being done on trust fund lands, for diamonds in particular, but is there exploration for minerals being done on trust fund lands? And if it is being done, does somebody else have those rights, or is it being done, is it being paid for through the trust? How does that work?
Well, Madam Chair. We hold regular mineral lease sales. There's exploration going on, especially in the Arrowhead area of the state and in the Aiken County, Carlton area of the state. Some of those lands are trust fund lands, some of them are tax forfeited, some of them are acquired. There are a variety of, we could give you the exact numbers of how many acres of school trust are leased currently. I don't happen to remember that. We have kind of curves of interest in various metals. So right now, platinum is high on the curve. Lots of people are interested in platinum. A few years ago, gold was very, very much of interest. The price of gold was $5.50 an ounce, roughly like that. So there was a fair amount of exploration further to the west, over in the greenstones and volcanics. There are new discoveries in Canada for diamonds. And we have similar geology. We've had diamond exploration here. We have a deep bed of glacial drift overlying our rock formation, so finding a diamond mine is really difficult. A good diamond core might be 100 meters across. And so, you know, that's 300 feet, and you've got 300 feet of drift, and you have to go find that spot. It's kind of challenging. But we have potential for all of those things, and the most potential for metals, if you went to your map, I could draw a geology map, but the most potential for minerals would be kind of like this. Things north would be the most potential for metals. And then the most potential for industrial minerals, we used to think were south, like Cold Springs, Minnesota River Valley, Kaolin, Dimension Stone, Limestone, Southeast for Limestone and so on. But we've also got some new Dimension Stone areas up in the Northeast as well. So, and then sand and gravel really varies based on the glacial drift.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bryce,
Senator
is
Kelly.
Peat managed as a mineral so that peatlands get the benefit that are being exploited get the benefit of the minerals subsidy, or they manage as forestry land?
Well, that's really an interesting question. There, Madam Chair,
Mr. Bryce,
the peatlands are managed as a surface interest, and the income is going is not going to the forestry suspense account. It's going directly in as a mineral, but they're being managed as a surface interest. So there's probably doesn't make sense in the way we, you know, because most surface interests go into the forestry suspense account, but peat does not do that. It goes directly to the accounts, the school trust or whatever the accounts.
So they still get to, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So they still get to our accounts. It's just the way they're designated.
Yes, and there's no expense against the peat revenues. Okay. That's correct. That's there.
So if somebody with a lease right discovers value, something, a mineral of value in school trust lands, then how does that profit get distributed?
100% to the school trust, currently under today's statutes. It's not profit though, it's everything it's the gross.
It's gross.
Goes to the school trust.
Okay.
Last year, because of that taconite grant, there would have been a 20% off the top number, but it changed between last year and this year.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, Bill, for clarification, it depends who owns the mineral rights.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were assuming trust fund.
Well, but the trust fund could have, in this instance, the trust fund will get the land.
But right.
The mineral rights. But mineral rights are still the way they were before, correct?
Right.
Okay.
So it depends how the trust fund got the land.
Okay, so if we happen to have the land and somebody else has the mineral rights, I guess that's what I was trying to get to, then what happens with the income from it?
Then we would, Madam Chair, then we would lease the surface, and that surface income would go to the forestry suspense account.
forestry suspense account.
Correct, because forestry manages the surface interest. This is really complex, and I'm sorry. Confusing everybody. Did I say that wrong? I didn't.
Good job.
They have to, my attorneys help me with your sales, right? So if the state owns the surface and a private individual state owns the mineral rights, then they would have to have the right to use our surface. And we would lease it if we thought that was appropriate, okay. And the income would go to the forest suspense account.
And does your charge for leasing depend somewhat on the value of what they're going to get out of there? Yeah, or is it just an average rate?
Madam Chair, it depends on what it's going to be used for. If it's going to be used for stockpiling, for example, we know that stockpiling 40 on the range might be worth on the order of $40,000. That would be considered in part of the appraisal. And we generally charge 5% to private individuals and 3% to local government. And I think I said that right, too.
9% to
6%. It's
9%
and 6%.
Okay.
Madam Chair. If I could ask
Superintendent Giroux.
Just a technical question. Can we sell these lands?
Madam Chair, yes, you can. And we sell a few parcels every year.
Absolutely.
If it's considered to be surplus.
The question was, what's the criteria for when the trust fund decides to, we've sold properties, put the monies under the investment board. What's the criteria that drives that?
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, generally it's if the land is surplus. There are a few cases where we have subdivided some land because we thought that was an appropriate income managing exercise for the trust fund, and those lands have been sold, like White Iron Lake. We sold 3 lots a couple of years ago, and those are subdivided and platted and sold as an income for the trust.
I guess the question, I'm sure the question might be asked, if the responsibility of the Department of Natural Resources in managing the trust is to maximize long-term yield for the trust, at what point do we recognize that it's more valuable for real estate development or commercial investor or any other purpose? When do we come to that conclusion, and how do we come to that conclusion, and what do we do then?
Madam Chair, and if I may, Commissioner, the other side is there's a yield coming from our investments, the fund's investments as well, and that weighs against it, because we've done that before, but I've never understood who drove that decision, because generally here we were kind of presented with the decision, but I never understood who drove the decision that said it is now greater value to sell this land and place it in investments, and frankly, we changed our investment strategy too somewhere in there, so it was more aggressive in the equities market.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Bryce.
Generally, the department has taken what I would say is a very conservative look at when to sell land, and we generally sell surplus land. But several legislators have raised the issue, which is on page 17, and that's that. That's the lakeshore lot.
Yes, and we've done that. Yes.
Okay, and we completed all those lakeshore lots, and you can see we exchanged 522, it's on the bottom of page 17, 522 acres of lakeshore lots, and which is hundreds and hundreds of lakeshore lots, for 6,550 acres of undeveloped lakeshore. And in just the last 6 months, we have legislators who have said, so what are you going to do with all of this new lakeshore? Should it be sold? It's not really timberland in a lot of cases. Maybe some of it is. And I think that's a policy decision that has to be made, that ought to be brought up, and maybe your committee ought to discuss this. And we ought to figure out how we do make that decision. Because, it's a recent event that we did.
But the question, I think, the threshold question is, what forces the department to review its land holding,
right,
and decide that holding the land yields more than selling the land?
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, I think, it's inertia. that the only time the department has sold land is almost without exception on any large scale is Lakeshore leases. It was clubbed into that.
Yes. Excuse me, Madam Chair. It seems Representative Recovita can't show up for those discussions.
I'm surprised he isn't here this morning.
Yeah. we're going through a massive review by legislative direction on our non-trust lands to parcel by parcel as directed by law of a couple of years ago to explore that very issue. But that excluded school trust lands. And I would say there's a real bias against selling land.
Madam Chair, almost a historical bias based on how the land was first received and original purpose. But the issue that ultimately came up, and I sensed it at one time and then everybody kind of dismissed, but at the time when the markets were aggressive and we had decent yields on the investments, that made tremendous sense. It particularly helped these transfers move along because there was the potential for investment. But even in the interest markets, unless there's tremendous market growth for the value of the land sitting around the lakes long term, and we can assess that. I've never seen that perspective. No one's ever really put together the total perspective of the investment land holdings, sales and retail for the trust fund as a complete unit. At least I've not seen that.
Well, the way Lakeshore is going, it's certainly increasing rapidly in value. Senator Kelly.
But I there are some interesting questions we could explore on that because, for example, with the commercial leases, is the long-term potential income from the leases equal to the, how did we calculate the net present value difference on a sale versus the long-term benefit from maintaining it for lease purposes? I wasn't involved, thank goodness, and we don't have to decide that today. It's obvious that we're going to take a lot closer look at these issues, so I'm glad to hear that the review is underway, Commissioner.
Representative Segrin.
There was a situation this last legislative session where we had three or five parcels of land on a beautiful bay, and there were some folks that wanted to let the people that are currently leasing retain their lease, and the department, DNR, to their credit, wanted to, raise those leases because they were just giving that lease away, or else I figured we ought to sell the land and, or exchange it, get some kind of an exchange. The DNR wanted to ultimately, I didn't want to sell that land, acquire that land so that you could have access on that bay, but have it more of a public access.
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, Representative, what happened in that case is that was the only lakeshore lease area that the legislature decided kept in public ownership, and so we gave them a lifetime estates on that land, and every 5 years, I believe, we were to reappraise and set the lease rate at the 9% that you heard. And the three individuals who are still on the property, all the rest of the lakeshore lots. This is Horseshoe Bay on Lake Superior, north of Grand Marais. It's a beautiful site. Those three thought the increases were too large, and so they went to their legislators, and legislation was passed to reduce that to 2.5%. 2% from the current rate, and of course, it passed.
Yes.
And what do you do if these folks are? This is not a state where they can hand it on to their kids. And so, it's one. There's two sides to every issue. Whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing to do,
that should be a fair price.
Now that piece of land, the department has always believed ought to be this trust fund. It ought to be eventually a public access or a public park or something like that. In order to do that, under what we're doing, we would want to condemn it at some point. and use it, you know, like if we were to make it into a park, of course, we're trying to exchange our land out of those parks. So we'd want to condemn it, and then we would get full market value of that piece of land to the trust fund in exchange for public access or park or whatever.
Because that's school trust fund land now.
That's true. That's
and we're not really getting land. The kind of, you know, value.
2% just doesn't really reflect the value.
The value of that land has gone up just dramatically in the last decade or so. So that the lease rates were at the 9%, were they like $15,000 a year in that order for a person to keep their lot, knowing that they were all in their 60s or early 70s or late 50s. And how long do you want to do that to keep your, you know, the last three cabin sites, gorgeous spot, surrounded by the state land you can use. So,
well, there's one of them, the way they've got it set up, though, one of the families, they have their other family members that are younger.
The younger generation.
And as long as that younger generation is there paying the lease, they can almost virtually keep that land. The other one or two, and I'm not sure if it's two out of them that have that kind of situation, just the one. The other, once, you know, they pass on, they can't, you know, pass that lease on. And then that will transfer back to what will happen. That will then become just, then we can do what we want to with it as far as exchanging it. And,
but we have to reimburse them for improvements, the cabin, whatever it is that they put on that land, correct?
Madam Chair, and both questions, I forgot, you're right. One of them, when they set that lease up, they put their children on there as owners. And so they're much younger. And they will get to keep that longer than the other two who are quite a bit older. We have to either pay for their improvements or they have to remove their, they have the right to remove their improvements, you know, to a different site or something like that. And one of my staff told me the other day that they thought that that was going to be in the order of 50, that $80,000 or something like that on the improvements for those three properties. But of course, it depends on when, you know.
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew the motion that the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee recommend to the Land Exchange Board approval of the proposed land exchange.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? I think that's unanimous. So we have that piece of business done. And obviously lots of questions for a future meeting, but I would like to move on briefly at least to item number 3 on the agenda, a little discussion of the trust fund lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. You probably remember that last session that became a really very contentious issue for a while, and we kind of quieted the waters for the time being, but they're... I'm sure there will be another gale coming. We've got to move forward and try and solve this issue to some extent, in that we have 90-some thousand acres of land that are in the Boundary Waters that the federal government never paid for, but that are school trust fund lands. So you want to address that issue. I think this is kind of for the information of the people that are on this committee, because this is something that I feel we need to try and figure out a way to deal with this in the next few years, and with our members of Congress, et cetera, and see if we can't get something done that will, you know, kind of permanently solve this issue.
Well, sounds good, Madam Chair. My name is Brad Moore. I'm Assistant Commissioner for DNR. And what I'm going to do today is give you a brief history on these lands in the Boundary Waters and what we've done to date. And then a little bit on just some future options for you to think about them, because there's, as you know, a great deal of policy questions regarding these lands. BWCA covers approximately just over 1 million acres. And of that, there's about 117,000 acres of state lands in the BWCA. And of that, about 86,000 acres have the trust fund status. If you turn to the map in your book, it looks like this, kind of folds out. that gives you a look at where those lands are. And a couple things to point out to you. School trust lands are the ones in blue, and those came to us from the federal government, and when we agreed to, in 1857, to become a state. The lands in red are called indemnity school trust lands, and they differ from the other ones in that on some of the townships, there wasn't a Section 16 and 36 available. So in lieu of that, they had these other indemnity lands. And then there's swamp trust lands, and those were granted to the state by the federal government in 1860, so just a few years after we became a state.
That's so nice of the federal government to get a swamp.
And if you add all those up, something you might find interesting, if you add those up on this map, it's probably just over 87,000, and you heard me a few minutes ago talk about 86. The way the map was generated, they used the corner points on sections. If any of you have looked at a USGS map of the Maumee Waters area, you'll see that many of the sections are not square. They're crooked, and the lines are all, you know, a section might not be 640 acres. It might be less or more. So the 86,000 acre figure that we use comes from our land records, and we think that's probably the best approximation of what's really in there in this trust. When you get up into that area, you might get surveys that they're hard to do, and the figures are approximate. With the passage of the Boundary Waters Wilderness Act, the state and subsequent actions, the state is not able to generate income off of our trust lands within the wilderness. And as you know, we have a constitutional mandate to do that. And therein lies the problem, is 86,000 acres, and yet we can't generate income from it. In 1986, we signed a memorandum of agreement with the Forest Service to do some land exchanges, and we actually completed a land exchange with respect to the Boundary Waters in 1993. It was about 2,500 approximately acres of trust fund lands. That's the last lands that we've been able to exchange. The counties have been able to do a few as well. They were more aggressive, I think, than we were in the 1980s and have made more progress on that. Since that time, in 1997, there was an attempt to buy out the state lands in the Boundary Waters. So the federal government would pay us. And there was a letter by the Minnesota Congressional Delegation to the Secretary of Agriculture urging an allocation of about $10 million for the acquisition of lands using land and water conservation dollars, so to get the process going. When that occurred, members of the Northern Delegation strongly opposed the sale of those lands. The Northern State Delegation. And so at the Congressional Delegation, nothing happened. They said, you know, in talking with Representative Overstar's staff, they said, State, you need to get your act together and decide what you want to do in order for us to jump in, because when we jumped in here, some of you didn't want it and some of you did. So there was a bit of a gridlock. Post 1998, the Office of Legislative Auditor said DNR should continue to pursue compensation for these lands. In 1999, the House passed a resolution, and it was signed, Minnesota House, and signed by the governor, memorializing the President and Congress to enact a law to expedite the exchange of state and federal lands. So the mandate there was to exchange, not to sell. In addition, what happened in 1999 is that $200,000 was appropriated from the suspense account that goes in the permanent school fund to do an analysis of the lands in the Boundary Waters, the state lands, to determine what they look like, what the character is, and to determine the valuation of those lands. There has been an ongoing debate about whether the stated value that the federal government uses is accurate or not. Some people felt that it was accurate, others felt that it undervalued those lands. So that study then, the money went to a study done by UMD and NRRI up in Duluth. And what they did is they took a look at the lands, and then we also did an appraisal on approximately just over 5,000 acres in the Trout Lake unit in the boundary waters and tried to do an appraisal of those acres to meet federal standards to do an exchange. And the Trout Lake unit, if you look at your map, there's a part of the boundary waters that's separate from the main body of the wilderness. It's in the western side. And the reason that area was picked is it had a high concentration of state lands and was relatively accessible for the appraisers, and you know, to get in there and actually do the appraisal.
So, Madam Chair, so when you say the Trouts, are you talking about like this land here? Mm-hmm. That's where it was.
Madam Chair, yes. NRI completed the study, and what we found, a couple of things, is that the approximation of the value of the land in the boundary waters was estimated in about $92 million. And when you look at the federal estimates of the land as well, they're in the ballpark. I mean, so what it showed was that the general, that $90 to $100 million at the time of this report, that's about what at least we think the land is worth. So the NRI estimate didn't greatly vary from the estimates the federal government uses for some of the payments it makes to counties.
Madam Chair,
Representative Segal.
I thought you said the federal government was only offering us $10 million for the
Madam Chair, Representative, that initial $10 million earlier was for initial to start the process. They anticipated that, let's say that that had gone through, there would be more appropriations over a number of years, so that the selling of the land would be done at one time, but it would be over a period of time. In the UMD study, the value of our land, the 5,000 acres, was approximately about $3 million for that 5,000 acres in that range. So what we did is we took that and sent a letter to, at that time, Dale Bosworth, Chief of the Forest Service, and said, we'd like to exchange this 5,000 acres of land. Forest Service wrote back and said, what we want you to do is work with Jim Sanders, who's the supervisor of the Superior National Forest, to do this. And they also indicated to us that while the exchange that we wanted to do is 5,000 acres, that when the Forest Service does the work on the exchange, they have to consider the cumulative impact on the total 93,000 acres of federal land that ultimately we would want to exchange, so that even though you're exchanging a small part of land, the analysis, the environmental analysis, would have to look at the bigger impact across the federal forest. And so what happened then is, we're at a point now where we've been in some discussions with the Superior National Forest and trying to determine what to do next. And here's why we haven't moved forward. When you do a land exchange like this, the federal government is required to do an environmental assessment, which is called an EA, and that's under the National Environmental Policy Act. That is a part of a very lengthy exchange process covering many, many steps. Bill, how many are you looking at? 30 steps? At least.
I thought it was 41.
It might be 41. All through that exchange process and then using this environmental assessment, there's opportunities for delays, there's places for appeals, and we know that there are some people are very much opposed to this exchange. And quite frankly, it's our belief today that if we were to try to do this, we don't know if we'd ever get it through. And the concern we have is, on one hand, we have an obligation to manage these lands, you know, to earn income. But if we spend a great deal of money on this exchange and don't get it, we wasted a lot of money in the process. And so we're really at a point is, when you look at the constituencies in Minnesota, there are a fairly significant amount of people that do not want to see an exchange. They believe that we should sell the lands, you know, the federal government should buy them. And their rationale are severalfold. One, they say that by selling the lands, we can generate the most income for the trust. And ultimately, when you look at the Constitution, that's our job. Many of the people are also opposed to us getting the lands in exchange, so the federal government would get our 86,000 in the boundary waters. We would get some similar amount of land outside, because the federal, they would have less of ability, for example, to appeal timber sales. The ability to fight timber sales at the federal level that's easier than it is in ours. And so there's an issue there. On the other side, there are people that say, no, we don't want you to sell because we want you to exchange those lands because we can use those lands outside the boundary waters to earn revenue for our loggers and our community. And we don't want to see the federal government just buy the lands. There are also those that say a sale is not in the best interest of the trust. They point out that when you see the escalating land values, had we sold that land back in the early 90s, and when you look at the land today, the land value is so much higher. Had we sold it then versus selling today, which you could have invested at, they said you could make more money if you sold it today. And that gets back to your question on, well, when do you draw the line on net present value? I mean, how long do you hold an asset and then sell it to benefit the trust versus selling it and investing that proceeds from the sale to benefit the trust? And I think that's a policy question that's before us.
Another policy question I think before us too is that, you know, also, if the federal government, you know, if we agree to a buyout of the land, but the federal government only doesn't, say the figure is $90 million, but they don't give us that money in one lump sum payment, we lose the value of that land too. I would, you know, if we were going to negotiate something like that, we should get that payment in one lump sum, not spread it over 10 years and have the federal government giving us $9 million a year for 10 years, because at the end of the 10 years, you know, that value is not as great as it would have been. So that's, you know, one thing. Can I also, too, for our next meeting, because I know we're not going to do this, could you give us a map that will show us in the Superior National Forest where the land would, our equivalent 90, or how many ever acres it is that we would have to exchange, where we come out of. We have some kind of layover or something to say this might be what you would exchange. Where is the Superior National Forest land? The potential of just so I can just visually see how much it takes up on a map. Just so it's hard for me to imagine that amount of land and where it's located in the Superior National Forest. And then, you know, we've got this spread out over here, but if you could kind of give us just a visual of that for the next, it would help me.
Madam Chair, Representative, we can do that. What we can't do yet is give you a specific parcels that we might want, but it can give you an idea of the scope and the scale.
I just want to, that's what
I want. Right. And on that point, one of the other arguments that's used against sale, and you can build up arguments, as you can see, both ways, is that we have a variety of trust fund lands outside the wilderness that are intermingled with federal lands. We sometimes have difficulty accessing those lands, our lands, because they cross the federal lands. And sometimes it gets very controversial where the environmental assessment has to be done for crossing the federal lands, which increases our management costs to get to our lands and time, et cetera. So there are places where an exchange of lands and blocking up our ownership, you know, where you have to cross a federal 40, make that a state 40, would reduce our management costs on other trust fund lands. And so there's some reasons also where some exchanges would be cost effective from both the federal government and our point of view, assuming, of course, the cost of trying to do those exchanges doesn't run into a prolonged illegal battle, which is probable.
Senator Kelly.
Well, Madam Chair, I have in mind the transaction costs in terms of time and staff effort for 462 acres, and we're the only party in the deal, you know.
Right.
So I can just imagine how long it would take to do 86,000 acres with the federal government. And related to that, is there a difference in management practices between the federal forest and the state forest in a way that relates to jobs.
Mr. Moore.
Chair, first on your first point, when you talked about the staff time, you're right, it would be huge. Regarding jobs.
I'm trying to understand better the opposition to it. I understand Mr. Bauman.
Madam Chair, just to be real blunt so everybody understands, we are near paralysis of harvesting on federal forests when it comes to timber. We still actively manage, I mean, that's one of the major impetuses of the Healthy Forests Act. Now, I think just passed yesterday in Congress is to deal with that problem. So, yeah, there's a and I think that's an important factor in a lot of these discussions. State forest lands are much more likely to be harvested for timber than federal forest lands.
That answers my question. Second question is, does the department anticipate making a new recommendation about what we should do?
With regard to BWCA?
With regard to the school trust fund lands that are in the BWCA.
Madam Chair and Senator Kelly, I think there's one other thing to explore that we've not mentioned yet, and that I think has some greater potential than anything else we're looking at in the short run, that we need the involvement of the federal government, and that's to put a surcharge on the permits for the Boundary Waters Canoe, recognizing that those trust lands are being used by the users of BWCA, and it would not be inappropriate for a small surcharge that would generate revenue. And I think there's a precedent for that, forgotten exactly where, on the East Coast someplace. But I think we would need to work with the federal government to accomplish that.
Well, and I ask that because, that is good to know, but listening to this discussion and thinking about this, I can understand how the legislature got to some of the, but I don't know that there's a current legislative consensus about what to do. And a recommendation might help us come to one. And I could see a 50-50 deal. I can understand the point made with regard to the management of state lands that are intermixed with the federal lands. But I also think let's get some cash in the door that can go into the permanent school fund that's managed by the Board of Investment and have something going on there. And the transaction costs on just selling the land are obviously going to be much lower than trying to do a land exchange. So I'm interested in getting a recommendation from the department reflecting changes in times, changes in attitudes, I don't care, but let's have some game plan for what to do that the administration's willing to support.
Madam Chair, Senator, and I...
Mr. Moore.
I think that's a good point. And in fact, one reason we have not pursued the exchange is a very concern about incurring a great deal of transaction costs and time without little to show for it on the other end. And so we've been just saying, we've got to think this through before we spend a lot of state money. And on the transaction fee, or on the user fee, as you might know, in the Boundary Waters now, a portion of the fee that users pay goes right back into the management of the wilderness. And so the idea of tacking on something so that we get an income off our land, would have a lot of merit, regardless of whether eventually the land is sold, exchanged, or stays put.
Right. And Madam Chair, I think that's another part of the question. I like that idea, Commissioner. The question is that an interim solution or a long-term solution? And we need some recommendations about that, because continued stalemate is not in the interest of the permanent school fund, And so if there's something we can do that will help get us off the dime and, you know, not have a unitary solution or have a temporary, maybe long, you know, something that the legislature can help to press on, I think that would be good.
Thanks, Commissioner Merriam, for your comments about almost no logging currently being allowed on federal lands. What is that doing to our industry in Minnesota, our logging industry? If they can only log on state forest land now, or on permanent school trust fund land, what is, how is that affecting our industry in Minnesota, jobs, et cetera?
Well, there's a, Madam Chair, there's a significant concern about that. And I don't, I want to be careful how I say that almost no, because that's subject to interpretation. But clearly the message from the forest products industry is a concern about harvesting on federal lands.
They'd rather burn it up, I think. Excuse me. So, you know, I think there would still be a lot of opposition from northern Minnesota on just getting paid for the Boundary Waters land, right?
Yes.
So is there an easier way to do an exchange than this whole process with the 41 steps or the 90 steps, whatever it was, that you mentioned? Is there an easier way to accomplish it? If we could get our congressional delegation all on board, would there be an easier way to accomplish it? Would that make a difference?
Madam Chair, at one point I thought maybe, but I don't think so now.
Why?
In the state of Utah, they did work with the Congress to do some legislation at the federal level to just do a broad exchange without the individual appraisals, you know, on the parcels and to go through the 40-step process. That particular exchange really recently fell apart, and there's been accusations going back and forth that some of the people that were involved in it undervalued certain lands and overvalued, and the Congress, from the information I've received, is very reluctant to go into another one of these congressional deals because of what happened in Utah, that the whole thing blew apart, and there's people being accused of wrongdoing in the process, et cetera. And so while I have not talked individually to our delegation, some of the reports I've heard is people are saying they want to stay as far away as that as possible.
Oh, great.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seeger.
I think some information we need for next time would be an analysis of the fact if we got $90 million and what would the interest be, you know, some kind of a, if we got a lump sum payment of $99 million, you know, what kind of interest we would earn off of that. You know, do a conservative, I'm sure, evaluation on that. But then also, I'd like information on how much money we would earn on a surcharge, you know, assuming some kind of a dollar figure for a surcharge, what you're making off of the Boundary Waters now and what that surcharge tacked onto it would be, and compare that to what kind of interest we would earn on, you know, getting land. So if we got sold the land, and then I would also like to have an analysis if we were able to, in 10 years, get land exchanged, what would be the earnings off of timber sales? And not only just the earnings, but I think you have to kind of, that may be part of
look at the industry,
like,
too.
You know, kind of the peripheral, you know, what happens to the economy when you have people earning and able to buy homes and whatever additional goods because they're making a living. And I don't know how you, if that can be done, but we may, you know, Steve talked about a 50-50. We may want to look at trying to look at some land exchange and do the surcharge and do, you know, some buyout and try to work with the Iron Range folks and see if you've already done an analysis apparently of 5,000 acres, and maybe that could be the impetus for some from land exchange there, and at least try to move us to some. I'm sure 5,000 acres is not going to be, is going to appease them, but if there's some way we could work out something with all the groups. I know the environmentalists are concerned too, but now we've got the new federal act with the, what's it called, the, that you said just passed, Gene, the
Healthy Forests
Act, yeah.
So this may, you know, shake things up a little bit more and allow some different attitude for some of the forestry. There has to be, you know, I think thoughtful people, common sense people have to try to work together on this. Certainly the environmentalists don't want to see our, you know, forests cut down.
Nor do we.
I think we want to have a constant renewing of our forests, and I think that we've got some good forestry practices that could help us move towards that. So we want some industry up there, too, and we also want to respect our environment. So certainly, somehow, rational heads can come together here and try to address everyone's concerns, and everybody's going to have to give up a little bit of their territory, but we can accomplish something.
Could we maybe have some of the information that we've asked for today, and I know some of this is going to take you a while, but could we possibly meet and discuss some of these options, such as the surcharge and what taking cash, you know, $90 million or whatever it's worth now a few years later from the federal government would do for us, et cetera. Can we have some of that information and meet again in a couple of months? Is that a possibility? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. I think we're definitely over time here, and I would like to, are there any final comments from members of the committee?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
You know, I might make the observation that perhaps at your next meeting, I mean, the permanent school fund consists of a lot of land and a lot of money. We manage the land side. It might be hooky to have these. Somebody here
Have Mr. Bicker here?
Yeah. That's a good idea.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Thank you. That's a good point. And
Madam Chair, another idea, too, that I was thinking about is, we are not authorities on the kind of mineral stuff that's existing in the state. And, for our own benefit, as we're land swapping with you guys, we're kind of on an even territory here as far as getting the best bang for our buck for permanent school trust fund land. But the aggregate issue, I think, is a big one because we need more and more aggregate all the time. And I would like an analysis of where the aggregate is in this state so that if you come up and give us some opportunities to trade for some and get some aggregate into the school trust fund, I'm interested in that so that we can maximize some value too there. So if you'll do that for us, that would be good too.
All right, we'll try to cover, all these other areas at the next point. And in the meantime, I think I will just make a few phone calls to our congressional delegation and see where they would sit on this. That should be interesting.
Yes.
Find out how courageous our delegation really is. Thank you all so much for being here and
yes,
for your comments and your information. It was this booklet was wonderful. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.
Best meeting I've ever had.
Stephen.